From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. It sounds like the ultimate deal. 2 years of free community college, no strings attached. President Biden wants to make that a reality for anyone who wants it as part of his American Families Plan. The estimated price tag, $109 billion. He spoke about it yesterday at a community college in Virginia.
You know, it really is how to start to transform the life and family and community and our economy. By investing in people, every child has a capacity to learn.
In theory, this sounds great, but how exactly would it work? Well, to understand the pros and cons, we're taking a look at the existing free community college program that's been around in Seattle for a few years now. It's called Seattle Promise. And joining us now is Seattle College's Chancellor Sean Pan. Chancellor, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So Seattle Promise was started as a pilot program in 2018. Now any Seattle Public High School student is eligible. How exactly does it work?
With the levy that's passed by the taxpayers, all high school students from Seattle Public Schools are eligible to receive tuition free to attend any of Seattle colleges free. And for those students whose family income meet certain standards, they also receive a what we call equity stipend, about $500 per quarter, up to three quarters per year.
There was a record number of applicants over the past year, despite the pandemic. Did that surprise you?
Really surprised. It's very clear. Seattle Promise is happening for the right reason, at the right time, for the right population. We were a bit surprised that given COVID-19, it certainly changed how students experience learning. But, you know, right now we have about 880 students that it's on the way to complete associate degree or enough courses to transfer to four-year university.
And about half of the city's high school graduates are taking advantage of this program. There is some drop-off in actual enrollments, though. What does that tell you?
Our deadline generally is early in the year, like January, February. Students were really trying to explore their options, many apply. We work in partnership with the public schools, encourage as many students apply so they have options. So when it comes later, there's a natural drop-off, certainly because students realize they have a very different options. What we are having very happy to see that consistent for the past 3 years, up to 93% of the students are from low-income, underserved population. It is for these students, you know, like 37% of them are from first-generation family. They would not have thought about getting a post-secondary credential were not for Seattle Promise program.
Seattle Promise is paid for by a special levy, as you mentioned, that voters passed back in 2018. $43.8 million was raised for that program, another $3.1 million for Seattle colleges. So there is a price tag here, and there definitely has to be political will. Is it a concept you find yourself having to sell to people?
We were so fortunate. We have a mayor, Mayor Durkin, who had great vision working with Seattle's city council. When it passed almost at 70-some percent. Overwhelmingly, Seattle's taxpayers, business leaders realized this is a huge investment for the city, for our community. It's a game changer.
Western Technical College President Roger Stanford out of Wisconsin has expressed some concern about President Biden's free tuition plan, saying that every state has different rules and tuition rates. He's concerned that if a national standard is set, it could put some community colleges in the red. Do you understand his concern? And perhaps what are some cautionary lessons you've learned from implementing the program there?
It's premature for me to make assumptions, but I'm so pleased to hear that this administration is considering that each college state has different circumstances. I'm confident there's a way to make this work. But what we have learned from Seattle Promise program since 2018, providing tuition does not guarantee graduation. It's really the other things, what we call the wrap around the services. Seattle Promise Program is unique in the sense we equip students not only with tuition, but we sort of use a case management approach. We have retention specialists who help students making sure they go to school. When they have difficulty, they have someone to turn to. Family issue, personal issues, juggling demands. The retention specialist, the wraparound services really makes the difference. So I hope as the White House and Department of Education considering this option, they're also looking at beyond just provide tuition.
That's Sean Pan, Chancellor of Seattle Colleges, talking with us about the Seattle Promise Program, a two-year free college tuition program for the community colleges there in Seattle. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tonya.
Well, now to Mexico City, where at least 23 people have died after a metro overpass collapsed last night, sending train cars plunging into the street below. Rescue workers have been searching the wreckage. Mexican authorities have promised an investigation. NPR's Carrie Kahn joins us from Mexico City. Carrie, you know, we're seeing images of train cars dangling from this overpass. Is that still the case? Describe what you're seeing.
It's a terrible, terrible scene. It's terrifying to see that. But the city brought in some huge cranes to remove the rail cars, including two that were the most heavily damaged and hanging precariously over the, you know, what was left of the overpass. Mm-hmm. The last image I saw was that one of the cars was finally down on the ground and they're getting the second one down. And one news report said that there were four bodies in one of the cars, so it's unclear if those four bodies mm-hmm. were in the original death toll or will it rise. Police and National Guards have just closed off a huge perimeter, so there's no way to get near the site, and it's hard to see mm-hmm. it all clearly. There are some overhead shots that I've seen. Like I said, they're just terrifying, these car rails that were just hanging over the overpass. A police surveillance video also captured the exact moments of the crash. And that's hard to watch. You see the train pass over, and then in seconds, the overpass just crashes, and the two cars plunged, like you said, 15 feet to the roadway below, and they're collapsed in like a V shape. Rescue workers were working in the dark, and they were climbing up on metal ladders and entering the cars through windows to bring victims out. And the number of injured is now in the 70s, and that keeps climbing.
Well, there were cars in the street below. One person was trapped in a car below but pulled out. This is a relatively new metro line, but there are reports in Mexican media that residents had complained of cracks in this overpass after an earthquake in 2017. So,
there is a lot of speculation going on now.
Yeah, about the damage then.
Yes, speculation going on a lot, but clearly the overpass and even like perhaps one of the huge concrete pillars that holds it up above the ground failed. Where and how and why, we'll have to wait and see. There was a huge earthquake here in 2017, and residents did complain about cracks and fallen concrete from one of the massive pillars that hold up this part of the above rail line. It's unclear, though, if it was the same pillar that was involved here. Was the maintenance properly done? Was the line actually built properly to international standards from the get-go? There's a lot of unanswered questions.
Well, and authorities have promised an investigation. Any sense of where that might go?
The president this morning said that they will call in an internationally registered external group to do an investigation. City officials will also investigate it. They've all promised to be transparent, do it as quick as possible, get out as much information as possible. So we'll have to wait and see what happens with that.
Well, Carrie Kahn there in Mexico City. New York's is the only busier metro system in North America than Mexico City's. Probably everybody there, you've probably been on this. What's the feeling there about this having happened?
Excuse me. That it's terrible. It's just those images are frightening. This is a part in the city where the metro comes above ground. And so everybody sees these huge pillars in this over above ground railway. And you always just think as you go under it, you know, I hope those things are sturdy enough to carry this. And the metro system here is huge. It's such a vital part of the city. It's massive. And it's the fastest, cheapest way to get around this huge metropolitan area, you know, of 22 million people when you take the whole metropolitan area, this is going to be a huge disruption for tens of thousands of people's everyday lives. Already you see people that lined up before dawn to get on ad hoc buses to get around this huge area and come into, you know, jobs and stuff. The pandemic has caused ridership to drop, but people still widely depend on this metro system to get around town.
So I'm sure people are, you know, nervous about what comes next. But just in the meantime, just terrible news out of Mexico City, this collapse of an overpass. We understand children were among the victims. Carrie Kahn reporting for us from Mexico City. We'll be finding out more. But infrastructure is a word that resonates here as well. So Carrie Kahn, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's been more than a year since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, but another epidemic has not gone away. Last year, more than 90,000 people in the U.S. died from drug overdoses, 20,000 more than the previous year, according to early data from the CDC, and most from opioids. That's higher than any year since the start of the opioid epidemic in the 90s. And in some places, overdose deaths of Black people have risen and fallen for whites. That's the case in Philadelphia, according to a recent study from the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Utsa Khatri is an emergency medicine physician and fellow at UPenn. She co-authored the study. Dr. Khatri, why is this happening? What's going on?
Addiction is really complex and influenced by so many factors, and a lot of the stressors that contribute to substance use have been made worse by the pandemic. We know that people have suffered a lot of financial distress. They've had problems with stable housing. They've been socially isolated. I've taken care of a lot of patients recently in the recent months who had been in recovery for many years but have relapsed and have started to use again because of the stressors of the past year. You know, I definitely have heard patients tell me anecdotally that getting into treatment is even more complicated now because of the COVID pandemic. Patients have had trouble seeking their clinicians. All sorts of social support services have been disrupted because of the pandemic.
Oh, well, there's also been an interruption to drug supply, we understand. We heard anecdotally from a medical provider in North Carolina cases where people were cutting their heroin with meat tenderizer or cleaning supplies, you know, just terrible. That seemed to be an element as well.
That's definitely been the case in Philadelphia as well, where we are seeing a rising in the rates of fentanyl contamination of other non-opioid drugs. And this can be quite deadly for people who are not expecting to be exposed to opioids such as fentanyl.
Yeah. Well, for years, the opioid crisis was largely associated with whites. And here in your study, you find in Philadelphia that the number of overdose deaths has risen for Black Americans, fallen for whites. And that's been the case in several other places in the U.S. What's going on there?
Yeah, certainly. The rises in opioid-related deaths have been increasing the most dramatically in communities of color. And it's important to understand that this trend was already underway, even prior to the pandemic. But the pandemic has disproportionately harmed people of color. And these harms and these stressors are likely contributing to increasing rates of substance use in communities of color.
Can you be more specific there? I mean, we, of course, have heard about African Americans not having as much access to healthcare, but how did it play out with the Black community in Philadelphia? Was it because, they couldn't get fill in the blank? I mean, what was the disparity?
Definitely the lack of access to treatment is a problem that existed even before the pandemic. We know that despite similar rates of drug use among different racial and ethnic groups, people of color, particularly Black Americans, are more likely to be criminalized for their addiction than sent to treatment. And this severely affects their prospects for recovery and survival. But even when people are referred to treatment for addiction, there are inequities that exist by race and ethnicity. So specifically, Black patients across the country are less likely to receive buprenorphine, which is one of the two FDA-approved medications that treat opioid use disorder and that has been shown to cut mortality by 50%.
And is it also as simple as saying, for both populations, white and Black, you know, COVID patients couldn't get into hospitals at some points. Was it that hospitals were overwhelmed? I mean, people couldn't have elective surgeries. They, you know, how did that impact people who needed help with addictions?
The entire healthcare delivery system was fractured because of the COVID pandemic. And so many places that were providing substance use disorder treatment in the early months of the pandemic stopped accepting new patients. While many places were able to transfer their patients to telehealth services for existing patients, many places weren't taking new patients. So if you were someone who was seeking help for the first time during the early months of the pandemic, your chances of finding somewhere that would accept you were low. And it was already low even, you know, before the pandemic.
Well, you mentioned buprenorphine. This is the drug shown to reduce opioid relapses and overdose deaths. And as you know, the Biden administration recently issued new guidelines about, you know, who can prescribe this and help patients and treat them with it. Many more medical practitioners than before can now do that. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's definitely a welcome first step. So you're right that the changes from the Biden administration effectively expand the number of clinicians who can prescribe buprenorphine, at least up to a limit of 30 patients. However, just because clinicians can prescribe buprenorphine doesn't necessarily mean that they will overnight. And it doesn't mean that care will automatically be equitably accessible to all patients.
Yeah. And we should say that previously people could only prescribe this medication if they went through special training and they got a waiver, which others have pointed out. There's just no other medical condition that requires that. So that change is being applauded. But still, buprenorphine has been known to be diverted, sold, and used illicitly. How does this problem start to get stemmed?
We have to see and treat opioid addiction and other drug addictions as being chronic diseases that have multiple factors that contribute to them. Until we within healthcare and folks outside of healthcare genuinely embrace this principle that people who use drugs deserve compassionate care, I don't think that we're actually going to take control of this epidemic.
Dr. Utsa Khatri, emergency medicine physician and fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, lumber is now a hot commodity. That's because we're in the midst of a building boom. Demand for supply is high, supply is low, and lumber prices are soaring. Let's bring in Robin Farzad for a closer look. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hey, Robin.
Hello, Tanya.
So we understand the what and a little about the why. We're in the midst of this building boom, but what are some of the other reasons why there's not enough lumber to keep up with the current demand?
Tanya, I think with like so much else in supply chain planning, I mean, you and I have talked about toilet paper, Purell, pickles. Who could have planned for this? It's, you know, put yourself in the fateful spring of 2020 and you run a lumber operation. The economy falls off a cliff. There's a record spike in unemployment and misery in just a matter of weeks. And so, of course, you're going to throttle your sawmills and cut workers. You're going to cut capacity and tell the timber trucks you just won't be needing that much this year. But then, bam, interest rates plummet. Everyone is at home. This unreal boom in home building, additions, upgrades for remote work, it's kind of like a fetish. If you go and look up lumber on Instagram and TikTok and everything, there are all these memes about, oh, look at that. That's an unguarded lumber truck going down the street. It's going to get hijacked. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, this stuff is more valuable than gold.
Well, I mean, this could be a very simplistic question, but why is it hard for loggers to easily cut down more trees and to ramp up production to meet this demand?
Well, start with the supply-demand curve you now see. And lumber that used to cost, let's say, $10,000 is fetching $40,000. And there are clear weights. If you're lucky enough to bid successfully, if you're a prospective home buyer on a property and procure the right builder and contractors, you could still wait months for the requisite amount of lumber. Lumber just doesn't appear. You have to grow the trees as timber. They have to be harvested. It has to be the right kind of tree, whether you're talking about a kind of a premium Pacific Northwest or Canadian cedar versus maybe some of the inferior stuff you'll find in Dixie. And there's a true lumber shock. I mean, it's adding about $36,000 to the price of a typically built new home, according to home builders.
Wait, how much?
about $36,000 to the price of a typically built new home and about $13,000 to a typical apartment. So it's not incidental. And yes, you have a housing price surge, but that is adding more than an incidental cost to a medium new home.
Okay, well, looking long term, though, will this have a larger impact on the overall availability of housing?
Well, you're already seeing the lucky sawmills that are kind of at full tilt. They're selling boards and finished lumber before timber is even cut from the forest. I think the point of the bottleneck varies across this continent. Premium Canadian logs, they've been shipping like crazy to sawmills. They're eager to sell finished product at the steep premium you're seeing. Kind of what used to trade for $200 per unit is now $1,000. But Canada has also been hurt by a beetle infestation. On the flip side, the South in the U.S., you have a glut of trees, but sawmills aren't going to be able to take this on. So you're seeing distributors and builders capitulate and say, you know what, I'll pay. Give me what you got. But at some point, that has to hit a cry uncle point, especially with affordable housing being so dear and so rare in this economy.
Okay, I have about a minute with you, Robin. So without increasing the supply of lumber, is this situation actually expected to continue? What might we see in the future? Do you think prices will get back to normal in any time soon, really?
We know that various hits could cause a housing slump. You recall the Great Recession and what happened to home building. Indeed, much of these sawmills that aren't able to get it up quickly enough, they cut capacity after overproduction in the financial crisis. So what if the Fed jacks interest rates? It's not only going to make mortgages more expensive, it makes investments in sawmills and trucks and timber tracks costlier. But if prices stay this buoyant, you're going to see the various industries in the chain, they're going to contort one way or another to meet demand. Maybe you're going to see cheaper replacement materials or alternatives. But at some point, like I said before, someone is going to have to cry uncle. These are ridiculous price hikes.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Nearly a third of the U.S. population is now fully vaccinated. And as we've been reporting, though, there's a fair amount of hesitancy. Now, some immigrant groups are working to increase vaccination in their communities. That's the case in one of Nashville's largest refugee communities after a prominent leader there died of COVID-19 recently. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN reports.
On a sloppy spring day in mid-March, hundreds of Kurdish Americans gathered in a field near Nashville under a sea of black umbrellas. Some of the men carried a stretcher to an open grave where a yellow backhoe was waiting. Following Muslim tradition, the body of Imad Doski was buried within 24 hours of his death, another casualty of COVID-19. It was more than a year into the pandemic, but it was a wake-up call to Nashville's Kurdish community, which is now the largest in the U.S. It's grown since a wave of Kurdish refugees started arriving 30 years ago after the Gulf War. Doski's death was a shock because he helped start the Kurdish mosque in Nashville. A nurse practitioner at the Kurdish-run clinic in town, Faiza Rashid, says Doski was in his mid-50s and relatively healthy.
Like, it hit people. They saw it happen to one of them, so, you know, it hit home.
The loss opened many Kurds to the idea of vaccination, Rashid says. The mosque he founded even scheduled vaccination events with the city health department. But even as Kurds have started to come around, new questions emerge. A top concern is that we're in the middle of Ramadan. Many Muslims are careful not to break their daily fast. The local imam assured members that the vaccine is allowed. Nurse practitioner Radour Abdullah says he's been telling more conservative Muslims it's not worth waiting a few more weeks.
I would recommend you get it and make up your fast another day. It's better than getting a virus.
The public health department has had to lean on healthcare workers in the Kurdish community to get these messages across. Sumeya Mohammed is a college freshman who works part-time at a pharmacy, and she trained to give COVID shots. At her mosque, 70% speak only Kurdish.
They would all be at my table, you know, because nobody else knew how to help them.
Mohammed says many are dealing with past trauma from refugee camps where vaccinations were not a choice.
I don't blame them. And like, I would be asking the same thing if I went through that too.
Her own mother, Sawad Abdullah, was putting off her shots. She doesn't get flu shots either. She still has scars on her upper arms from vaccinations she received as a child living in a Turkish refugee camp. She's always been told they're from an infection because workers weren't using new syringes.
They were just putting it over the fire to basically sanitize it and use the same needles to inject us with the vaccinations.
She knows COVID is serious. Her own uncle was hospitalized for weeks.
But as far as the vaccination and trusting that it is 100% protect me from this illness, that has not been proven to us.
Her daughter, the pharmacy tech, has been working on her, explaining how the vaccines work and how effective they're proving to be, then praying for an opening.
Eventually she gave in, thankfully, and she said, I'll only get it if you give it to me.
So at their mosque, Sumaya Mohammed gave her mom the first dose before she could change her mind. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
And this story was produced in partnership with NPR, Kaiser Health News, and Nashville Public Radio. Schools are juggling a lot right now, including how to spend COVID-19 aid. More than $190 billion spread throughout the country as part of the federal relief plan. And now the U.S. Department of Education has issued new rules on how K-12 should spend that money. Today, we're visiting Columbus City Schools, the largest district in Ohio, which is expected to receive $288 million from the latest congressional relief package. And this money is significant for a district where 81% of students receive free or reduced price lunch. Talisa Dixon is superintendent of Columbus City Schools, and she joins us now for more. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, Dr. Dixon, your job is to manage 50,000 students, 2,800 teachers. How has the last year been for you and your staff and your students?
Well, you know, it's been, for me, one of the most challenging years of my entire career. And just making sure that I can give answers to my staff and families. They have so many questions about this pandemic. What does it mean for our students? In our families, and how can we get back to some sense of normalcy? That has been the number one question from my families and staff members.
Your district received $160 million from the first two rounds of COVID funding. Now you're expected to receive this additional $288 million. Put this in perspective for us, because we see that Columbus City Schools has a typical operating budget of more than $700 million. How have you used or planned to use that COVID funding?
Yeah, well, first, we want to make sure that we can provide some additional supports for our students. So we are hiring additional school counselors, additional social workers, and making sure we have also literacy specialists for it, because we know that our students have not been reading on a regular basis and really engaged in learning like we would want them to. And we have those at our disposal for every school building in the district.
Right, because having additional counselors actually solves a problem that you had experienced before the pandemic, because not every school actually has a counselor.
No, not every school has a counselor, not every school has a school nurse, and not every school has a social worker. So many of those three very important people in those areas have been shared throughout 109 buildings.
There's also infrastructure, repairs, and upgrades. Last year, it was reported that a quarter of Columbus City School buses are now more than 15 years old.
Yes, we transport almost a little 30,000 students. So we needed to make sure that we have those new buses that are conducive to transporting our students safely, and also making sure we upgraded our ventilation systems and have air conditioning and heating in all of our buildings. We have them in all of our buildings except for 16. 16 of our buildings will receive HVAC upgrades in 2022. So we're going to do those next year. But we wanted to make sure that we have those pieces done in our building, and as well as technology.
Yes, let's talk a little bit about technology. The lack of reliable internet access is a very real problem here in the U.S. Columbus was fully remote until November, and yet the district is one of the poorest districts in the state. The child poverty rate is about 30%. How do you begin to approach that problem?
Well, we learned through this pandemic that we have to approach it together. It's not the district's a problem to solve on our own, that through partnerships with our local health officials and others, that we can solve the internet access problem. And we also learned that families had access to it but couldn't afford it. So we provided over 4,000 families with internet hotspots along with a device. So we have that continuity of access for all of our students.
In the last year, you faced a lot. Staffing shortages. You've been criticized by the governor, Mike DeWine, for not bringing back all of your students on the state schedule by March 1st. What you're talking about, is that how you will approach next year as you're thinking about how to serve the needs of your students?
This is a global pandemic, and we are the largest school district. So there's a heavy lift. So we can't turn this ship automatically, as some people will want to. But I believe people understand. Now is the time for us to say we're going back in the fall. We're going back 5 days a week. We've worked closely with Columbus Public Health to make sure our teachers are vaccinated. And I am, as a leader. And that's important. And it's important that we get back to some sense of normalcy. We can't go back to the way we did things before. Our students deserve more. And we are going to utilize these funds that we are receiving, report back to our community and to our stakeholders, just what we're doing with these funds that we've been blessed to receive.
Talisa Dixon is superintendent of Columbus City Schools. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we go now to Montana, where for the first time in almost 30 years, that state will have not one but two seats in the U.S. House of Representatives based on the latest U.S. Census population counts. And while many there are celebrating that news, there's already a fight for political power. In this story that originally aired on Weekend Edition, Montana Public Radio's Shaylee Rager reports.
In his home office overlooking Montana's small capital city of Helena, Joe Lamson unrolls a map he's particularly fond of. It shows the state's legislative districts in the early 2000s. Lamson says Montana historian Harry Fritz used to say this about it.
This map came out, and he said it's the best map drawn in Montana since Lewis and Clark came through.
Lamson, a Democrat, has been thinking about the state's districts for more than four decades. He was a political staffer and campaign manager, and now he's a member of the state's districting commission. For the past 30 years, he's been crunching numbers, trying to figure out how the state can regain the congressional seat it lost in 1990.
The growth rates in the other part of the country were we just never could keep up. And I didn't think that we'd ever get our district back in my lifetime.
In 2022, Montana will send two representatives to D.C. for the first time since 1993. So I asked Lamson how he celebrated.
I sat out on my deck here and poured myself a couple of glasses of wine.
Instead of lawmakers drawing new maps, Montana's Districting Commission was created by the 1972 state constitution with the goal of taking politics out of redistricting. Lamson and the other members have been planning to get to work this summer. But the morning after the news of the new district came, Republican lawmakers in the state were already trying to muscle their way into the process. Lamson says he was disappointed, but not surprised.
This is kind of out of the Republican national playbook.
Senator Greg Hertz and fellow Republicans rushed through a policy to give themselves a seat at the redistricting table. It sets out rules for the commission to follow when drawing district lines.
No one likes gerrymandering districts, and that's my primary concern. You know, people need to be represented in their common areas where they live together, in the valleys they live together, in the communities they live together. It's much easier to contact your representatives when we have districts that look like that.
At a Friday press conference, Republican Governor Greg Gianforte declined to say whether he supports the measure, but did say that he doesn't want gerrymandered districts. Democrats pushed back against the proposal to no avail. They say the districting process shouldn't be politicized by the legislature and that the bill is unconstitutional.
This isn't something that should benefit one or the other. This should benefit the people.
Tahin Perez is deputy director of Western Native Voice, a nonprofit that advocates for Native American empowerment. He stresses that Native Americans have been historically underrepresented in the state, in part due to gerrymandered districts.
These districts should recognize and be appropriately representative of the communities that are in Montana.
Tribes in Montana have fought what they call unfair districts in the state before, have won, and have won more representation because of it.
Going out to vote is a way of honoring the ancestors and honoring the people in the past who have made those kinds of sacrifices and who have gone into courtrooms to fight those battles for equal representation.
Perez says he's ready if those battles need to be fought again. For NPR News, I'm Shaylee Reiger in Helena, Montana.
The dance world is a little sadder today, having lost Jacques d'Amboise, the New York City ballet star who died Sunday at 86. For decades, he was the face of American ballet. Then, after he stopped performing, an ambassador for dance as founder of the National Dance Institute, a program which gives free dance lessons to New York City kids, some tough kids like he once was. One of my earliest memories as a kid was standing at the edge of a stage after Jacques d'Amboise's performance to profess my love to him. One of the joys of this job was telling him that. We spoke several times. In 2005, he was in Boston to work with some student dancers and accept an award.
Keep going.
He told me about his early days in dance in the 1940s. Let's listen back to some of that visit.
I'd leave school, get on that subway, grab an apple and a nickel. Right? And if I was held after school as a punishment, the whole class or anything, I'd miss that ballet class. So my mother went to that principal and told him, if he's bad, punish him in a different way, but he cannot miss his ballet class. So after a few months or so, we were being punished again. Everybody had to stand up, face the back of the room, and then the nun announced, Jacques can leave for his ballet class, right? So coming out of the subway that night, right on the corner, Dave's Candy Store, my gang is waiting. What the hell is this dancing stuff, right? And I said, it's great. And I had my little practice bag, and I put it down on the sidewalk, and I said, there's this guy, Andrei Aglevsky. When he jumps, he floats. And there's a step called soprasol. And let me show you. You have to jump in the air, move sideways, and land on the other side of this bag. And then I had everybody putting Coke bottles and trying to jump over him. And by just saying that I was doing something so great and was proud of it, I had no problem. And then when I joined the company at 15, I would sneak my gang in to the city center so they could see me. And right? I was so proud and excited about it. And I was a good athlete on the block. And when I was a teenager, I could run out and jump over a car. I would literally run and jump over a car.
Really, you could?
Yes, I could jump over a car. And I loved to work. I always thought of each performance that I did as my first one and my last. And I would try to do, and I'd dedicate it to a teacher, and then I'd do my best. Then it would finish, and it would be over. And then I would think, now tomorrow I'll work to make this better. And the next day I'd say, now here's my first performance as a new, better dancer, because I worked all day on something. And so it was a constant enjoyment in the exploration of the possibilities that I had. My life had been transformed through the arts. I can say hello and goodbye in 15 languages and count in those languages. I've pretty much danced and been to most places in the world, but all because of the arts. And I dropped out of high school.
Not to mention, I have to inject here, as someone who grew up in New York, I mean, there was a time when, I remember my heroes were, you know, Mantel, Maris, Jacques d'Amboise, big, big stuff. How do you get a kid as interested in dancing as they might be in baseball or football?
Well, first of all, people don't realize what dance is. For example, I'll ask you, what do you, Robin, in one sentence, give me a definition of dance?
Dance is when people move and they tell stories and express joy and other emotions.
Okay. Now, if listeners are listening to this and they'll all agree.
Say that's the wrong answer?
No, they'll agree with you. It's fun, they'll say. Or it's, you get moving. Or it's moving to music or something. Now, let's stop and really think what it is. If I was to stick out my hand to say hello to you, I wouldn't give you one quick little short shake and pull it back, because that would be a sign, a communication, that I don't like to hold your hand or I don't like you. I wouldn't grab your hand and pump it for half an hour, 10,000 times. There is a control of movement to communicate an idea or emotion. Shaking the hands is a dance. Every time we take and pour a little wine in a glass and raise it and toast someone, we're doing a dance. It's an invention by the human being to express emotions by controlling the way we move in time and space. It's profound.
New York City ballet legend Jacques d'Amboise in a 2005 interview. I can now say that I danced with Jacques d'Amboise because I think I shook his hand. He died Sunday at 86. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.